From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New York, New York, even the name implies a double identity, a secret life, two sides to a churning metropolis that is an urban legend all its own. New York, New York has grace and grit in thousands of American movies and books, TV shows and plays, skyscrapers and the egos that soar with them, dark side streets and immigrant dives, West Side Stories and Wall Street, Breakfast at Tiffany's and Life on the Docks. A thousand settings, one sprawling character, one humming city. And there you have or had Manhattan's magic, its narrative appeal. It's the kind of place that can steal fiction's best punchlines, where writers and artists, directors and producers find more than a backdrop for their work. They find a character all its own. Since terrorists wrote themselves into New York's life 1 year ago, since hijacked planes and collapsing towers gave every American a New York story, Manhattan, the character, has changed. But how? We'll be talking tonight with Gay Talese, Wendy Wasserstein, Neil Baer, and you. How is the New York City of September 2002 different from the one you knew just a year ago? From the New York of your favorite book or show? And if you were to describe New York, the New York you once knew, what words might no longer apply? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined from the studios of WNYC now in New York City by our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty, who's been out gathering some New York stories of its own. Jack, I know it's been a while since you've been in New York, and it's the first time you've been there since September 11th last year. How does the city feel?
Well, as many people have felt coming here, it's a city with a different pulse, missing a beat. Its nimbus now really is one of destruction, loss, and mass murder. And you're aware when you're flying in that you're looking for something that's not there. And then you realize that the missing towers will define an era in the life of New York, just as the Brooklyn Bridge, the Empire State Building, and the pre-9/11 towers did. But those were vaulting symbols, really, for vaulting eras. The missing towers, their tonality could not be less vaulting. And there's no comfort somehow in Phoenix-like metaphors for the buildings, perhaps, but for the 2,819 people killed here, no resurrection is possible.
You know, Jack, I'm sure that's true. On the other hand, over the weekend, I saw in the New York Times Magazine a story about everything that might be rebuilt there, that could be rebuilt there. And it's a strange week. I think everybody's emotions are on edge. I was brought to tears by thinking of what could still be, of how that New York, that surging New York that we love, could still be again.
Yes, but I think that there'll always be, even if there are buildings mm-hmm. there, there'll always be something missing.
The hole.
Yes. And that's what it is. It's a hole down there.
What are you hearing from New Yorkers?
Well, I heard from a friend last night a sort of emblematic story of September 11th, sort of initiation into disaster story. Just as she was leaving her apartment, she heard on the news that a plane had crashed into the World Trade Center. And she thought, well, a Piper Cub, a mm-hmm. drunken, you know, there had been a similar incident just a couple of years ago. Remember that one?
Yes.
Empire State Building. She gets on the train and starts to go downtown, and at the next stop, someone comes along and says, it was a 747. She hears that talk. At the next stop, she hears someone saying, there was the second tower. At the next stop, she hears someone said, they've hit the Pentagon. She walks to work. She gets in work. The one tower comes down. Everything goes black. And then that's followed by a sort of blizzard of paper, just confetti falling down for minutes. That clears. Life comes back to a kind of gray medium. And then just as everything is recovering, it happens all over again, worse to worse.
It
was just
tower.
And then she said that in the basement of her building, people were saying there are 13 jets on their way to New York.
How many towers can we lose?
Yeah, how many?
Taking that subway into the heart of grayness there. What's the buzz today, Jack, around the city?
Well, the front page, when I got up, the first thing I looked at was the front page of today's Post. And it's a picture of a businessman in a mottled suit on September 11th walking across the plaza, or what was left of it, a famous, iconic photograph that was on the cover of Fortune magazine mm-hmm. right after the attack. Mm-hmm. But now it's a broken icon because the headline says, Blood Money. And the man, Edward Fine, is now charging journalists, guess what, $911 for interviews.
This is a survivor of the World Trade Center collapse cashing in.
Yes, and it says that, unbelievably, that he's a public relations man.
or was or is of a sort.
Yeah.
Did you make it to Lower Manhattan today, Jack?
I did get down there, and you know, right across from the hole, there's a Liberty Heritage Trail kiosk on Liberty Street, and it begins with this question: what has 200 elevators, 1,200 restrooms, 40,000 doorknobs, 200,000 lighting fixtures, and 700 square feet of acoustical tile, and was built for $1 billion in 1970. The sign hasn't caught up somehow with the reality. And then you go around the corner where there's the platform for looking at the site, and you know, I saw a Japanese family holding hands and praying, the man wearing a Yankees cap. I saw a woman in tears handing a photograph to a policeman. I saw a pair of cowboys. And at the end of the walk, two men were reading aloud the obituaries that appeared and indeed are still running in the Times, you know, of the dead, those little wonderful
reciting them in the open.
Yeah, and they had got to the B's, and what I heard was Carlton W. Bartles, Mrs. Bartles, and then Mrs. Bartles says that Carlton had an antic side one time while visiting Thailand, and his voice trailed off, blotted out by the sound of a very different city.
A city that stands for more than itself, or always has in literature and the arts, and that's what we're looking at tonight. Jack, stand by. We're talking tonight with writers and producers about the New York they knew, the New York they know. Gay Talese will be joining us, and Wendy Wasserstein. Our first guest, joining us from Burbank, California, is Neil Baer, executive producer and head writer of the NBC drama Law & Order Special Victims Unit, a weekly police drama filmed on location in New York City. Good evening and welcome, Neil Baer.
Hi, nice to be with you.
It's great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us. Neil Baer, you've been working on this show for a while, and you know New York City in the way that someone who's producing there knows it and someone who's writing for the city knows it. Before 9/11, what was the essence of this city? What was its important face for your show?
Well, for us, we shoot about 5 days out of an 8-day shoot in Manhattan or Brooklyn, sometimes in Queens as well, Harlem, the Bronx. And so it was more, you know, just the daily travails of how do we make it work? How do we get the actors and the crew into Manhattan? And how do we shoot on location? We always like to shoot as much as we can on location because we say on our show that New York is a character, just like Mariska Hargitay and Chris Maloney and Ice-T. New York is the setting, but it's also a vibrant character. So before 9/11, it was really sort of the day-to-day struggles of how to make the show work in a crazy place where trucks are blocking you and that kind of thing.
And that was part of the character, but a lot of the character comes right through the show. Talk to us about the city itself as a character in your show. Maybe in terms that you'd use to describe a human character. Who was, and then maybe who is, New York?
Well, before 9/11, the city was a place where you could find all kinds of things that you can't find in Los Angeles or really pretty much anywhere else in the United States in terms of shooting. You could find any ethnic community you wanted. We could shoot in Harlem, which we did for an episode before 9/11, and went into people's apartments, and you just cannot get the vibrancy of the real thing on a set. So we would be welcomed in everywhere, down at the court in Lower Manhattan, all the way up, you know, to the Bronx. And we just tried to find as many interesting looking places as we could, diners and places below intersection, underpasses, warehouses, places people don't know, the most expensive brownstones you can find, the poorest flop houses you can imagine. Mm-hmm. Everything is available in New York. And before, it was a place of kind of, you know, sometimes struggling just to have our voices heard as we were working there. But always we were welcome because New York is a character. It's when you show the streets, and you show many of our actors. I should say most of our actors we cast out of New York, so they have the accent, the vernacular. They seem real, so they're part of New York too, and it just gives a flavor of being a show that is really happening, as opposed to a show that takes place in a kind of make-believe world where there are sets and it doesn't look real.
Neil, are there themes, are there storylines that the New York setting, the New York character, will no longer support post 9/11, that jar somehow now, that just don't fit the city anymore now that we know that day in its history?
For us, not really. I mean, we're still solving crimes, special victims, takes into account the elderly, child abuse, as well as sex crimes, which is what the focus is of the show. And unfortunately, those are still going on. I think what was most interesting about 9/11's aftermath for us was the discussion about how we depicted our characters. Did we depict them with their foibles and often not maybe being heroic, or did we want to make them more heroic than in the past?
It must be a big deal, especially for the police, who have become less ambiguous figures somehow in the public mind since last September.
But have they really? I mean, this is a big question, because for our show, we really struggled with that, you know, question of should we show Mariska and Chris's characters as being, you know, always heroic, or can we show them making mistakes and having questions and questions about their faith, which we did with a show with Chris Maloney and dealing with the Catholic Church and priests. But I think what's interesting is there are other shows that are coming on. There's The Shield, which shows police as non-heroic. There's a new show called Kingpin that will be on about drug dealers, and they're hardly heroic as well. So the question is, has 9/11 also caused a kind of reaction that, you know, we've seen so much about their heroics, you know, why are there these shows now that are showing sort of the deepest, darkest underside of the heroes as well? And I think that has something to do with 9/11 and our fear, our possible loss of optimism. For us, though, we feel that it's important to show our characters as, you know, caring detectives. They can make mistakes, but they really do care. And possibly, I think, just because of the nature of 9/11, they care a bit more. They want to help more. Mm.
Jack Beatty, as you stand in New York today and you run through the library of films and shows and books that feature it so prominently, whether it's Tom Wolfe and Bonfire of the Vanities or Ragtime or The Godfather, are you feeling the electricity? Is that New York that we kind of count on as a nation, is it under your feet there today?
Well, I mean, you can sense the vibrancy, and when you're uptown, you're in a different world. Indeed, you don't really feel you don't see any visual cues to the disaster until you're practically upon it. I mean, suddenly there's a barricade on Broadway, and there it is. But on the other hand, psychologically, in your emotions, in your memory, it's graven there, and it makes all the difference. The sort of, you know, joyous bounce of Leonard Bernstein's New York, New York, and On the Town. I don't think people are going to be singing about New York that way for a long time to come.
We're going to hear more tonight from people who are thinking and writing about New York right now, from Wendy Wasserstein and Gay Talese. But Neil Baer, you're sticking with New York. Law and Order is right
Absolutely.
There and on the case.
We went back. It so happened, I want to tell you very quickly, that we had a miniseries, actually the biggest miniseries that NBC was going to ever – that NBC had done up to this point, a five-hour miniseries about bioterrorism. And it was a week from being shot in New York City, and we wanted to do it with Dick Wolfe to underscore – our vulnerability. Needless to say, we didn't have to. We were really...
It was scrapped.
It was scrapped because we didn't think it was appropriate to show buildings being blown up and people being exposed to anthrax and the possibility of smallpox. We were very alarmed at how close our scenario was.
That's an interesting aspect, that the New York is setting for disaster film.
Right.
We'll come back and talk more about the New York character. For the artists and dramatists who depend on it, for the nation that depends on it, is New York still that bold, gritty peacock of a city, that fantasy of twinkling lights and romance, of pride and power? If you can make it there, can you still make it anywhere? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Wilbur.
burst like bubbles in the fun of a Sunday in New York. You can spend time without spending a dime watching people watch people pass. Later you pause and in one of the stars there's that face next to you.
From Boston University, this
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the character of New York City in literature, on stage, and in movies. On the silver screen, almost no one conveyed the New York character more lovingly than Woody Allen. Here is Woody Allen's New York in his movie, Manhattan.
Chapter 1. He adored New York City. He idolized it all out of proportion. He romanticized it all out of proportion. Better. To him, no matter what the season was, this was still a town that existed in black and white and pulsated to the great tunes of George Gershwin. Now, let me start this over. Chapter 1. He was too romantic about Manhattan, as he was about everything else. He thrived on the hustle-bustle of the crowds and the traffic. To him, New York meant beautiful women and street-smart guys who seemed to know all the angles. Too corny for men of my taste.
Woody Allen, loving Manhattan in the film Manhattan. We're talking tonight about the New York character. What's your favorite face of New York, your deepest impression from books, film, from the street? Has it changed since 9/11? Has it survived 9/11? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Neil Baer. He's executive producer and head writer for NBC's Law & Order Special Victims Unit. We're joined now from New York City by Wendy Wasserstein, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and author of The Heidi Chronicles, and in 2001 of Schick's A Goddess, a book of essays featuring a parody of New York real estate scene. Wendy Wasserstein, good evening and welcome to On Point.
Hi, how are you?
We're great. Thanks so much for being with us. Wendy, sure. we're trying to get a grip tonight on the New York character that has lived and thrived in American literature on stage and in film, and what its health is today, if it's still out there, if it's still got its actor's card, if it's still in business.
Well, you know, one of the things about New York is it is a place where creative people come to begin their life in art in many ways. This summer, there was something called the Fringe Festival in New York, which was, I think, 100 off-Broadway plays, and they were amazed by the success of it. It was a highly successful enterprise, and I still think from the young people I know, playwrights, actors, dancers, musicians, still come to New York. After 9/11.
I'm sure they will.
That's still true.
When we look back, do you think that there will be a fissure through 9/11 across New York's character, that there'll be a visible pre-2001 New York character and a post-2001 New York character? Are we losing aspects of I don't know, pride, arrogance, joy, thrumming, humming New York?
I think it becomes a part of the texture of a New York character. I mean, there was always a romanticization of New York. I mean, New York, New York, it's a hell of a town, or Woody Allen's Manhattan, that's, you know, it is all a romantic vision of what was then. Also, I think that what the tragedy of 9/11, and it is a horrendous tragedy, will become part of the life of those who live here and continue to live here, but I still believe that those who would come to New York will still come here.
Do we lose something as a nation if we don't have quite that same romantic gloss on this city? It's played such a central role as our kind of a leading metropolitan lady. Can it still have that verve, or is it now always to be a more checkered sense?
It's perhaps a more soulful verve. I think in terms of verve has a lot to do with seeing the depth and then continuing. And I think in some ways it gives the city a soul and a heart, which, I mean, in a deeply sad way, but also in a way that does continue.
We're talking tonight about the New York character. For the nation that depends on it, for the artists and dramatists that depend on it, does Sex and the City still work for you? Does On the Waterfront What's your favorite face of New York? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Wendy Wasserstein, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. Wendy, you're a native New Yorker, born in Brooklyn, immigrant parents. I wonder how the past year has wended its way into your work. How do you anticipate that it will influence your work to come?
It's made me think a lot more about my parents. My father came from Poland and came to Ellis Island and then came to New York. And then he started a ribbon business and, in fact, opened a factory on East 18th Street. And this spring, I went to a gala for the Museum of Modern Art, which is closed and now in a temporary home in Long Island City. But their gala was on West 18th Street, so I went down there and there was the mayor and this wonderful philanthropist, Aggie Gond, and all these famous painters and Wynton Marsalis. And it turned out that this gala was literally at my father's old velveteen factory. And there was something about being where they used to cut the ribbon and seeing Wynton Marsalis there. And I thought, this city continues. It still has that, it has a history to it and a depth to it and, frankly, a humanity to it. And I think that, myself as an artist, makes me want to write about that, makes me want to write a personal history as someone who grew up here and someone whose parents came here.
What do you think your father would have made of what we all saw a year ago in his New York?
I think that day was horrendous for so many people. My father has some memory issues. So I thought of my father this day happening in his New York and him being lost in this New York, which is something I want to write about.
Jack Beatty, we've all read and loved that romantic New York. It's a hard thing to let go of. If we come to accommodate it, does it mean that we become more nuanced as an American audience, wrapping our hearts and minds around a city with a more nuanced history now, for sure?
Well, right. I mean, it's no longer just a cliche background. I mean, setting a movie in New York usually meant one of three things, you know, the gangster movie, the young lovers meet, or the, you know, profession, sweet smell of success, you know. Now the tonality is just whatever you put in set there is going to have some of this tincturing it. There's just no way around it. And, you know, there's also been a kind of dystopic New York. I saw a poster recently from the First World War. It showed a Hun in New York Harbor, and with one boot, he's reaching out, and he's about to crush two buildings that look awfully like they were right where the World Trade Center was, when planes are coming in from above attacking New York. And then you have Orson Welles' War of the Worlds. You know, the last scene of that is of the monsters creeping, or the battle scene is the monsters starting across the Hudson. They're in New Jersey and they're working their way, their ray guns on the city. I mean, this has been, the destruction of New York has preoccupied imaginations for a long time.
But somehow that always worked because it seemed invulnerable.
Yes, that's true, isn't it? I mean, you could say, well, that was all just a fiction, and King Kong dying on the Empire State Building, just a dream. But now a reality.
Jack, Neil Baer, Wendy Wasserstein, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation best-selling author and journalist Gay Talese, who joins us from Ocean City, New Jersey. Good evening and welcome, Gay Talese.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Ashbrook.
Thank you so much for joining us. Gay Talese, this description of New York City appeared in Offbeat Wonders of New York, an article you published in Reader's Digest in October 1960. You said, New York is a city of things unnoticed. It's a city where cats sleeping under parked cars, two stone armadillos crawling up St. Patrick's Cathedral, and thousands of ants creeping on top of the Empire State Building. The ants were probably carried there by winds or birds, but nobody is sure. Nobody in New York knows any more about the ants than they do about the panhandler who takes taxis to the Bowery, or the dapper man who picks trash out of 6th Avenue trash cans, or the medium in the West 70s who claims, I'm clairvoyant, clairaudient, and clairsensuous. Do we still have that New York of small moments of almost dear small moments?
Well, of course, that's part of the imperishable part of the city. Unlike some of the buildings that, in the case of the World Trade Center, have vanished, New York has always been a towering city. It's been a city unlike any other in casting long shadows. It's a city of shadows. The people you mentioned in that book I wrote long ago are the obscure people. We're now in the end of a year of mourning. I do believe, since I've written so much about some of the buildings of New York, some of the great structures of New York, I wrote a book about the Verrazzano Bridge, I wrote about the Empire State, the old many skyscrapers. And I've spent a lot of this last year with the New Yorkers, the workers, the hard-hatted men who built the World Trade Center. It so happened that I'm doing a new version of an old book on the building of the Verrazzano Narrows Bridge, which was completed in 1965. And many, many of the people who built that bridge later on in 1968, 69, 70, 71 were the workers of the World Trade Center. And I have spent a lot of time with those New Yorkers who were on the World Trade Center in this past year. And what I have picked up from being with these men is a sadness, of course, as we all have, at the awful innocent disappearance of so many New Yorkers, but not interestingly, sadness in the disappearance of the World Trade Center as buildings, because those buildings and these men who put the iron together and who dealt with the flaws of the building and much of what we've read in the New York Times today and yesterday, for example.
About the weaknesses of
the building. Yes, you read the wonderful magazine piece in yesterday's paper, and the front page article today testifies to the fact that the World Trade Center was a very flawed piece of work. We do make a martyr of it, it has gone along, but I think it's now being reassessed as a place that does not represent the best of New York. It was a shoddy piece of work, the World Trade Center.
Gay Talese, are you suggesting that that angle of the World Trade Center somehow speaks to New York's character now or in the recent past?
I think we're in a period of reassessing much of New York. New York has always been into self-analysis. It's a city of that. It's always blended, as your previous guest, Wendy's parents and mine from foreign, and Neil and his interest in the architecture and the character. Use the word character of New York. Well, New York has all these characters that are sometimes out of step. The wonder of New York is the fact that it's such a varied city, such a conglomeration of so many clashing cultures that through Ellis Island, as Wendy said, come and make New Yorkers of themselves. But New Yorkers also examine what is the character, and sometimes they find flaws in the character and they amend it. We're now in a period of our buildings, in this great skyscraper city, our buildings are going to be more strongly built. There's going to be more of an emphasis on safety. The people who died, maybe needlessly in the numbers, were the result of a flawed workmanship, proper fire protection.
So you see a New York...
Steel. That's going to change.
You see a New York, Gay Talese, in some sense going back to an older, more classic New York character.
Well, you know, 90% of the World Trade Center was air. It was such an empty space. It was for rentable space. It was designed to give the most rentable space possible, and there was a minimum amount of interior columns. That's why those planes, which were, after all, aluminum wing planes, went flying through that like a piece of cake. Now, that wouldn't have happened in many of our structures. I don't think the Brooklyn Bridge would have taken a beating like that. It was an old 100-year building, practically. Certainly, I don't think the Empire State. But that's all off the question. The question is, New York today is in the annual, is 1 year of mourning, but also as regard to those buildings, those word prints, I am not lamenting their disappearance. I may sound harsh, I may sound unsentimental. I'm not lamenting the loss of those particular buildings, because those buildings were not built with the idea of protecting New Yorkers at the utmost, I believe.
Wendy Wasserstein, what about the notion of the physical loss New York suffered and how it intersects with character? We imagined in the 90s that everything, certainly cities, were headed toward a time when they'd be bits and bytes and light and air and speed and not so much granite. Gay Talese is suggesting that a little more granite and steel may be necessary to the city.
I completely agree with Gay. As somebody who grew up here, and I lived in Brooklyn till I was 12, and we would drive into Manhattan. So it was before the World Trade Center was built, and then it went up. I never, in my imagination or romantic vision of New York, it never was the World Trade Center. Even in Woody Allen's, when that opening shot of Manhattan, or when you think of that Gershwin music, in a sense, what you said about going back to a classical New York is very true.
in every way. And a classical New York also goes back to a verb and a diversity and an intensity and, in a sense, a forward-looking city.
Neil Baer, when you put New York on the screen every week in Law and Order, Special Victims, can your characters have that old cockiness, whatever the setting, whether it's in the skyscrapers or in the tough parts of town, and the skyscraper land can be a tough part of town, we've now learned, but can they have that same strut that New York was famous for?
Of course they can, and they do. It's interesting. We never used the World Trade Center on our show except in the opening credits, and we took them out right after 9/11, and there was a lot of debate about that. It was kind of what we called a pictorial adjective. It's like, this is New York. And yet, funnily enough, we never used the World Trade Center. It really never played a part in the show because I guess as writers about New York, it played certainly a financial part, and it was people's lives, of course, but it didn't really express what we were trying to express in many ways, which is just sort of the everyday lives that people have. It's the crimes didn't really take place there. We aren't down there as much, but I think that even though it was certainly horribly tragic, characters have to move on. They're certainly affected by it, but they won't lose their passion. Mm-hmm. Because the writers haven't lost their passion about New York. Certainly that's who they are. And our characters really are who our writers are in many ways.
Gaetalise, what can the rest of the country still count on from New York in terms of a character that comes into our literature and onto our stages and screens?
Perseverance, endurance. You know, the city has been, during a time of the revolution, it was invaded. The people who come to New York, the parents of Wendy and Neil and all the people you have on your show are really people who are the offspring of a group of people who were dissatisfied with where they were, and more important than that, took the step of getting on a boat and doing something about it and leaving. The whole history of New York, especially New York, the great port city, has been a city that has taken within to itself people who have had the gumption to get away from what was wrong about where they were and to remake themselves. And the city of New York remakes itself with each new generation. Now the Asian influence and the people from all new parts of the world are the new immigrants, the new Irish, the new Italians, the new Jewish people from Poland, like Wendy's forebears. We're now renewing ourselves, and this building that's gone and disappeared is going to be renewed with something probably more true.
Gaetalise,
the character of New York, that's what I think.
We'll look for it in your work. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Gaetalise is author most recently of Unto the Suns. We're talking tonight about the New York character. What's the word that captured New York's character for you a year ago? Does it still apply today in the same way? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
New York, New York. It's a hell of a town. We've got one day here and not another minute to see the famous sights. We'll find the romance and danger waiting in it.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the character of New York City in literature, on stage, in movies, and television. Here's New York's own Jerry Seinfeld on New York.
To me, the really funny thing about New York cab is you never really get that scared when you're in the cab. I don't know why. Something about being in Manhattan, no matter how dangerous it seems, it's all quite amusing in the back of that cab, isn't it? He's flying around the road. He's doing 90 up a one-way, and you're going, I'd never try that in my car. It's all a huge joke. It's your life. And somehow it's all happening on TV there. It's all not quite real.
Jerry Seinfeld on New York. We're talking about the New York character in American literature, on stage, on screen tonight. What artists and dramatists depend on New York for, what the nation depends on New York for. Our guests are Neil Baer, he's executive producer and head writer for NBC's Law & Order Special Victims Unit, and Wendy Wasserstein, Tony Award and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, author of The Heidi Chronicles, The Sisters Rosenzweig, and last year, Shiksa Goddess. You can join the conversation as well. What has New York stood for America, for you, in film, between the book covers, on TV, and does it still? Is New York still that bold, gritty peacock of a city? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Wendy Wasserstein, what about the book that came out, your book that came out in 2001, Shiksa Goddess? It was essays featuring a parody of the New York real estate scene. Did it? Does it work a year later? How do you read it on the other side of September 11th?
The whole issue was interesting. Do you remember after 9/11 there was suddenly all this sort of, you know, pithy saying that irony was dead?
It was dead as a doornail.
Yes, dead as a doornail, and that famous issue of The New Yorker had no cartoons in it, mm-hmm. the one with the black cover. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, irony crawled back, humor crawled back, Saturday Night Live became acerbic again. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, in the Shiksa Goddess, a lot of it, the essay about real estate is a satirical essay because you can only look at it as satire. In a way, I think when you're asking about the character of New York, what will always be true of New York is a sense of humor and the thought that humor has come back to this city after that tragedy is, in a sense, a testament to its vitality.
And is everything game?
It's game in a different way. Of course, in the same way things are not game, in the way that they were never game. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, the death of over 2,000 people is not game.
It's not funny.
It's simply horrendous. Mm-hmm. But I think the character of being a New Yorker, and what you were talking before about the characters on the Special Victims Unit and mm-hmm. that sort of swaggering and mm-hmm. that idea of a New Yorker is still true. Jerry Seinfeld is still funny and will be funny, and he's a New Yorker. He lives up the block.
And always will be. Ross
yeah.
is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Ross. You're on the air.
Hi, I was just maybe a Midwestern perspective on the New York situation.
Yeah.
In the sense that having been there many times, New York is currently being portrayed as a reaching, touching, feeling place. Our heart goes out to it. Certainly was a tragic thing that happened. Mm-hmm. However, I can think of the times where people were reaching, touching, feeling my legs as I tried to circumvent their presence on the sidewalks. The poor, the impoverished, the helpless, the sick, and the injured. No one cared. No one helped. Dog eat dog. A year later, I would suggest that it's not that much difference. And I guess it may sound cruel, and I'm not trying to be cruel, but yet, had it happened in Chicago or Minneapolis, there would be no difference. I don't think it would be that different.
You don't think an event like that would change the essential character of those cities?
Do you really think in your heart that it would be that the people of Minneapolis or people of Chicago would have responded differently had it happened there? I guess.
Well, no, I'm sure they all would have turned out to help their fellow city residents. But I guess the question is partly here, Ross, is how big an event does it take to go to a city's fundamental character? And let me put that, if I made it, to Neil Baer. Neil, does this change the ground that your show is filmed on?
Well, literally it did at first because we couldn't go back and shoot in Lower Manhattan. But as soon as we could, we did. So we wanted to show life going on as New Yorkers have to go on. And so it only changed things in the short run in terms of what we could do, but it certainly changed things forever in terms of the way it's always in the backs of our minds. Mm-hmm. And we try not to write about it all the time, but it pops up every so often on SVU. Sometimes we debated. We had someone, Mariska Hargitay, said, where's Richard Belzer once? He's such a hypochondriac. He thinks he has anthrax again. We debated, should we say that or not? And we said, well, you know, we want the humor to come to seep back in. And mm-hmm. these characters would say that because people say that in real life.
And Wendy Wasserstein, to our caller's question, do you think New York has made more of its woe than any other city would, or been more or less generous in its response?
You know, I mean, I think New York has been resilient in the way that New York would be, in the way that it is different than if it's here than in Minneapolis, because it's simply a much bigger place than it is in Minneapolis. And I think in terms of New York, and in, you can't separate New York out from the rest of the country. Mm. What it's changed is our sense of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a change for New Yorkers, but I'm afraid that's also a change for Americans.
We're going to live it with you. Wendy Wasserstein, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Sure.
Wendy Wasserstein is Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, author of The Heidi Chronicles, and last year's Shiksa Goddess. And Neil Baer, thank you so much for being with us from Burbank.
Thank you so much.
Neil Baer is executive producer and head writer for NBC's Law & Order Special Victims Unit. Jack Beatty, you're there in New York. The city's swirling around you. And do you still see all that potential for story?
Oh, yes. I mean, you know, from Henry James to Scott Fitzgerald to Richard Wright to James Baldwin, Jay McInerney, Dave Eggers, on and on and on. Writers write about this city, and they use it for different as a metaphor for different things. I just think for them, for everybody, the metaphor is now much richer, sadder. A kind of verve. What did Wendy say? A soulful verve.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we're all counting on that to process what's happened here. Jack, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. In a moment, rolling through the anniversary of 9/11 with Mozart. This is On Point. Around the world on September 11th, there will be many musical ceremonies and memorials, but the Rolling Requiem Project may be the largest in each of the world's time zones at exactly 8:46 a.m., the time the first plane crashed into the World Trade Center. Choirs and orchestras will begin performing Mozart's final composition, his Requiem. As the 50-minute piece ends in one time zone, it will be about to begin in the next. Worldwide, over 15,000 performers representing 180 concerts in 25 countries will perform the Mozart Requiem. Tonight, we hear from the Rolling Requiem's organizer and one of its 15,000 worldwide participants.
Madeline Johnson, and I'm the chairwoman of the Rolling Requiem Committee. The story behind the Rolling Requiem is a really wonderful one. Those of us who are in the Rolling Requiem Committee also sing with the Seattle Symphony Chorale. And in January of this year, we performed Mozart's Requiem as part of our regular concert season. After our first performance, one of our singers had a chance encounter with a woman who had been in the audience. And she said, as I listened to you sing Mozart's Requiem, I had a vision of all of you and other choral singers ringing ground zero, singing Mozart's Requiem, one voice for each person that was lost. The idea of ringing ground zero expanded to become an idea of ringing the earth.
My name's Lori Doherty. I'm a member of the Avenue of the Arts Chorale soprano section, and I've sort of become the coordinator of the Boston performance of the Rolling Requiem. Once I read about the Requiem, I was so struck with the whole concept. It just seemed such a moving idea to be part of something that potentially thousands of other people would be involved in around the world. But I brought it right to my chorus board, and it was a no-brainer. About 30 of us are singing in this performance, and we have nearly 120 people singing with us. Most of those are from other choruses in the greater Boston area. It's very, very thrilling.
Some amazingly unique and wonderful responses from choirs all over the world. The first one that comes to mind is the choir in Riga, Latvia. And they said, we'll sing in the largest cathedral in our country, and we'll invite all the other choirs in our country to join us there. And last week they posted a list of the choirs that will be joining them, and there are 19 choirs. We also received an email from Antarctica at the Amundsen Scott Research Station. We heard from some of the people there asking how they could download an MP3 file of Mozart's Requiem so that they could play a recording of Mozart's Requiem in Antarctica. In the Middle East, we did not have a huge response. We do have three choirs in Israel that are participating as formal Rolling Requiem choirs. And we're aware of another combined Israeli-Palestinian choir that plans to sing Mozart's Requiem as part of a larger commemorative service, and they will be singing in the evening. But we like to claim that we helped pull that combined choir together.
Normally, when we're on stage, we're focusing on the next note, the next measure, the next page of music. And I think we'll be feeling more than thinking really intensely. At rehearsal, there were some people who found it really hard not to break into tears on the stage. And standing at the back of the hall myself, as I was scurrying around, I turned and looked up on the stage at this huge number of people who have come together for this, and filling the entire floor and the altar right up to the back wall of the church. And it was just an incredibly moving moment. The sound in the church and just the physical presence of those people coming together is just a really, really moving experience.
When we started this, of course, we had no idea what the response would be. Several months into the project, when we began to hear from choirs all over the world, then our understanding of it shifted, and we began to see that, to some degree, the Rolling Requiem and all of the other commemorative activities planned for September 11th represent a kind of a counterbalance to the terror and the horror and the destruction of a year ago.
Responded profoundly and instantly to the idea of being part of this event that involved thousands of people around the world for 24 hours. You know, when we think about the notion of standing on the stage at 8:46 a.m. in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, and knowing that as we're taking our first breath to sing our first notes, the notes have just died out in the previous time zone. And as we're coming to the end of the Requiem in our own time zone, it will just about be 8:46 a.m. in the next time zone, and the next choirs in Central Time will begin to sing. It's almost a visceral sensation of feeling as if we're touching all those other people and sharing something much larger than ourselves at a very profound level.
Madeline Johnson is chairwoman of the Rolling Requiem. Lori Doherty is its Boston organizer and will sing soprano on September 11th. To find the Requiem performance nearest you, visit their website at rollingrequiem.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.